Hello, everybody. Welcome to the new bonus episodes, or the bonus series, for the second season. I attended the Costa Rican Big Data School, and, you know, I thought that maybe some of you can take some value out of this. You know, many aspiring computer scientists and software engineers would really benefit from the things that they talk about in this event. This was a five-day event from Monday through Friday, from 8 to 4, so it was pretty extensive, and they talked about a lot of different subjects and, you know, very important things that you got to know in this day and age with big data and data science and data analysis. So I thought, you know what? I'll put this up. Maybe some of my listeners can take advantage of this and can benefit from listening to really, really high-end professors from the Texas Advanced Computing Center. So our instructors will be Wei-Ya Xu. He's a PhD and the group lead for Data Mining and Statistics Group. Prior to joining TAC, he obtained a master's degree in biological sciences and a doctoral degree in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. Then there's also Charlie Day. Charlie Day is the Director of Training and Professional Development with the User Services Group at TAC, with a background in web development and scientific computing. Charlie's responsibilities at TAC include organizing, developing content, and building curriculums for TAC's academic course selection taught in conjunction with several departments at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as for TAC's professional development and educational team. Oh, well. Oh, and just a quick thanks to Danny Xie, who was the one who recorded these segments. Without him, we wouldn't have this awesome bonus round. So thank you very much, and enjoy.
All right, so there were a lot of algorithms being used today. Even though we technically didn't see them, we had a Rasia showed us what the algorithms looked like, and then we were able to apply those algorithms using Scala and Spark. But one thing we kind of want to do, and one thing that I always like to do, is get rid of the entire black box, this mystery box that just kind of does magic for us. So one thing I want to try and look at today is exactly how to do some numerical analysis, or what numerical Python looks like. And to do that, we're going to do a little bit refresher course of linear algebra. So just show of hands, how many of you guys took linear algebra back in college? All right, so everybody took linear algebra, fantastic. How many guys still use your linear algebra today? A couple of you guys. All right, so we're going to do a little bit of a refresher course in linear algebra, just to kind of hit the high points. One reason being is the reason linear algebra is important, especially when we're analyzing data, because linear algebra is the language of data. All right, that's what it comes down to. So some of the applications for linear algebra is what I have listed over here. You know, every kind of engineering problem you can possibly come across. Doing graphs and networking, Markov chain, population growth, economics, the Fourier series, doing statistics and probability, and of course computer graphics, because that's all we're talking about. I was introduced to linear algebra through computer graphics. I have a professional certification in 3D programming, and that's where my linear algebra experience came from before I actually officially took it in college. All right, so as I said, we're going to be talking about vectors and matrices for the most part. There is a reason I'm bringing all this up, and the reason is going to be when we actually start messing with some computational linear algebra. So essentially what we're doing is we're going to be studying vector spaces and mappings that require linear transformations, meaning transferring matrices from one type to another type, scaling, transposing, whatnot, okay? So linear algebra is the mathematics of data, and then matrices and vectors are the language of data, because that's how everything gets related. So we can talk about how data looks like, you know, when we're trying to solve just a simple y equals 4x plus 1, you know? It just describes a line on a 2D graph, right? We give a value of x, and we get a value of y. We get another value of x, we get another value of y, so on and so forth. And then, of course, we can grow that out to make a system of equations. We're giving a value of x, and then we get two different values of y, And then, of course, we can plot the two different lines. We can see where the lines intersect at, see where all the information is coming from, and, you know, just get a lot more information out. But then when we start solving things like this, which is, all right, there is there a solution for an x1 and a y, and an x1 and an x2 that satisfies both equations? Well, that's where, you know, when it's a simple problem like this, yeah, we can solve it by hand easily. You know, we can do substitution, we can do a quick little Gaussian elimination or whatnot. But when things get bigger and more complicated, well, that's when, you know, this is still a relatively easy problem to solve, but how do we solve it? How expensive is it for us to solve it? And when I talk about expense, we think about expenses all the time when it comes to computation, right? We're developing algorithms, we are writing code, we are calculating and solving big problems. But all of that solving of problems comes at a cost. There is a number of units that you're using, the computational doesn't matter, cost. You know, we even, I think in our welcome to tax slide, I talked about how everything is a service unit. Service units are how many compute nodes you're using and how many hours of compute nodes do you require, and that has something that we charge you for, and then there's data that you're being, the data that you're being stored on a drive is being, has a cost associated with it. I mean, why are we so concerned about speeding up how much it costs to solve a problem? Because the longer it takes to solve a problem, the more expensive that problem becomes to solve. Because of everything that goes where, hardware, our time, people's time, the electricity, everything goes into that kind of issue. So when it comes down to solving something, what we're always trying to do is solve AX equals B. And we're always trying to find some method of solving AX equals B. So Gaussian elimination, I'm sure you guys are all familiar with it. So Gaussian elimination essentially sets you a set of rules that you can use to solve an equation like this. You know, you can go through, you can reorder the equations anytime, anywhere you want. So the first equation, I can swap that with the last equation. The middle equation is small, and it stays the same. I can go through and I can divide any one of those lines by any other kind of number. I can add, I can subtract these equations together and still get a solution that works. So that's all Gaussian elimination does. It just sets you up a bunch of rules on how you can better eliminate certain variables or certain coefficients to make your equation easier to solve, right? So you can multiply any row by a constant, you can switch any rows around, you can add any two rows together, and essentially what you're doing is you're trying to get that diagonal to be, the diagonal to be ones and zeros everywhere else. Because we're all kind of familiar with that, I'm not really gonna worry too much, but I was gonna show you. I usually do this by hand, but because the dongle that goes with my iPad, I actually can't do that. But essentially what we're doing is we're solving a system of equations, right? And a system of equations that we're solving can be represented in a matrix. It can be a matrix and a vector of x and a vector of b. And as soon as this decides, let me see if you're ready. So we take a system of equations and we show that into x and we run through all of our different rules that we can do. And eventually what we want to do is something that's a little bit more solvable. So we have a lower triangle of zeros, and we have a diagonal, and we have an upper triangle in our matrix, right? So now we can solve, all right, so x3 is equal to 2, so then we take the value of x3, we put that into the next equation, we get a value of x2, and then we put all those equations in the last one, and then we've got our solution. Easy to do when you have a very limited number of equations to solve, right? So there's other ways we can do matrices as well, things that we look at. These are just some vocabulary to keep in touch with. We can transpose a matrix, right? We can flip our rows and we can flip our columns together. Essentially what that does is it makes your invisible line can be drawn through the matrix from the top left to the bottom right, and everything kind of flips and rotates, right? We can invert our matrix. So matrix inversion is a process of find another matrix such that when multiplied, it results in identity matrix, right? So identity matrix is just the ones going down the diagonal, zeros in the upper, zeros in the lower. So there exists a matrix that when you multiply the two together, you get an identity. The trace, that's just what the sum of all the values in the main diagonal going from top left to bottom right are. The determinant, determinant's one of those really weird things to try and comprehend, but I really, really like that quote from the book called No Bullshit Guide to Linear Algebra. So the determinant is a square matrix and a scalar representation of the volume of the matrix. You like think about going, what the heck does that mean? My father's a mathematician, so yeah, that's a definition he would use. But looking at it, the determinant is a matrix A that tells you what the volume of a box is going to be if the sides were given by the rows of A. That makes a little bit more sense. I'm looking at what the scalar representation of the volume would be. So that makes a lot more sense to me. The rank of a matrix is the estimate of the number of linearly independent rows or columns. And then, of course, we can do a bunch of arithmetic. And this is where we're heading towards. We can add matrices together. So two matrices of the same dimensions can be added together, and you create a third matrix, right? Similarly, you can subtract. And subtract any two matrices of the same dimensions and get a third matrix. We can do matrix multiplication, which is not true matrix multiplication as we usually think of it, but this is just two matrices of the same size can be multiplied element per element, and you get a third matrix, right? Then matrix division, take one matrix divided by another. And then what we like to call matrix multiplication, or what everybody normally refers to as matrix multiplication, is when you have two matrices, essentially what you're doing is you're adding a rule on what the matrix size could be to be able to get them multiplied together. So if you have matrix A and B, you'll get a new matrix of size C, which is the same number of rows of A and then the columns of B. And as long as the columns of A and the rows of B are equal, then you can multiply them together. All right, and then of course, this is what the matrix multiplication would look like. So I have that matrix is A, the next one is B, and then what C looks like. And that's really what kind of comes into play. Okay, so all that stuff is just general rules that we're going to be able to use. One thing we do in computation, or at least computational science you all understand, is we approximate. We don't actually, we cannot always find an exact solution to an existing set of equations. We always have to take a rough guess and then some sort of a method will exist that tells us if that guess is good or not. I mean, yesterday when we calculated the value of pi, all right, we came up with a solution that is a rough estimate. And we can increase the number of sample size, right? But as we increase the number of sample size, what's going to happen to our computation time? It increases, right. So we increase our computation size. Now we're spending more money to calculate pi. So we can get a better estimate if we decide, all right, you know what? I don't care about cost. We'll just go crazy and get a better estimate and just take as long as we need. But that's where parallel programming comes into play at. So in regards to our pi calculation yesterday, well, let's say we did how many of you guys did like a 1,000 number sample? All right, so I saw some of you did 1,000 yesterday. How accurate was the value of pi? Not very accurate at all. What was the order that you had to get to get an accurate value of pi? Say three or four significant figures. Did you play with it a little bit?
Even with 1 billion.
Even with 1 billion. Wow. Okay. So with that, now imagine. Let's say we say a billion divided among 20 different computers, so each will do one section of the loop for you, and then you take all that information together and you come up with it. So, you know, 10 computers doing like a million each versus one computer doing a billion, you're actually looking at a significant increase in jumps. Something like that we would call is embarrassingly parallel. The problem that we were solving yesterday is embarrassingly parallel because each independent loop, each loop of our for statement, each run of the loop is independent of one another because we're just looking at random numbers. So anybody can generate those random numbers and each number is independent. So the loop is independent of one another. So that's an embarrassingly parallel problem that we can solve. So we can essentially, a situation like pi yesterday, we just throw more computers at it and then shrink our number of time that it's going to take to compute. All right, but that's not quite what we're doing here. Here we have a system of equations that we're trying to solve. We have, right now, the thing we started, we had three equations and three unknowns. But the cancer project that I'm working on has 500 equations and 500 unknowns. So there's a lot of things that are going into play. And even methods like what I'm going to show you today isn't something that we can actually use. We have to kind of break out and discover new methods. All right, so if we're going to solve AX equals B, we can do a direct method. You know, we can go through the Gaussian elimination process and try and find out what the exact solution is. But it can be very expensive to try and find that in time and space, meaning in the amount of time we're using to compute it and how many computers are going to be used to compute it, right? In fact, the Gaussian elimination problem is how many of you guys have heard of the top 500 list? So the top 500 list, especially in supercomputing, that ranks the fastest supercomputers in the world, the top 500. Stampede 2, which is our machine, comes in like number 15 or 16 or something right now. The math problem they solve is a problem based on Gaussian elimination. They just basically go nuts and see if they can solve a big, giant Gaussian elimination problem. And that gives you a number at the end of how long it took to run it, and then some other variables thrown in, and it gives you a number that ranks how fast your machine is. Okay, so what we're going to be doing, what we did with Pi was a sequential method. Okay, we're essentially going through a sequence, loop to loop to loop, and finding a value that will essentially meet what our criteria is. What we're going to do today is we're going to look at iterative methods. Okay, so iterative methods, they're cheaper because they're cheaper in space. They don't need as many machines to run it, and sometimes even cheaper in time because we're just looking for an approximate answer. And honestly, sometimes approximate answer is good enough, you know, than the actual answer. All right. The only problem with iterative methods is that they may not converge, so they're not guaranteed to converge. But there are some rules to follow that you can basically find a way of making the equation converge. Okay, so essentially what an iterative method means is I don't know what AX equals B is. So what I can do is I can take a wild guess at X. And I'm going to take that wild guess and I'm going to substitute in my equation. And I'm going to keep on doing this until my error, which is epsilon, between my previous guess and that previous guess is going to go through some algorithms and is going to come up with a better guess. And then I'm going to take that better guess and go through the same algorithm and get even a better guess, and so on and so forth. So as soon as that little error between my two guesses are nearing epsilon, then I can say, all right, this guess is good enough. Let's proceed to the next operation. So that's all this little bit of math is saying, is that, hey, keep on iterating until we get to an error that is acceptable. So let's look at this example that we have, some equations here, right? We have a system which is, you know, that given by that matrix. Then we have the vector of x and we have the vector of b, right? And obviously we can look at that and we go through everything. We know the solution is x1 equals 2, x2 equals 1, and x3 equals 1. We substitute that back in there and it works, right? Ooh, and this slide didn't come out quite right. But if we look at that and we see, you know what? My diagonal is very heavy. You guys can see that, right? That the diagonal values are much greater than the upper triangle and lower triangle values. So if I were to take a wild guess, I can ignore that lower triangle, I can ignore that upper triangle, and just solve for that diagonal, right? And I get a solution of 2.1, 9 divided by 7, and 8 divided by 6, which is very close to what the actual solution is. Okay? So what this does is says, all right, you know what? Just from a little bit of simple, essentially ignoring half the problem, I can come up with a solution that is somewhat close. But what if we decided, you know what? Let's iterate through this a little bit. What if we took what our solution is, what we thought our solution was, and then we substitute in those values? So let's go back to our example. Or I guess actually in this slide what we're showing is what if we ignore half the triangle? Let's just ignore the top half and just concentrate on the bottom triangle and the diagonals. Once again, we have an equation that is easy to solve. You know, we can solve it by hand pretty well. And we get a slightly better result. We have 2.1 7.95 divided by 7 and 5.9 divided by 6. Once again, really easy. All we did now was we ignored a third of the problem and just solved two-thirds of it. And we got a pretty easy solution. Unfortunately, sometimes it takes a little bit more. So what we're going to do is we're going to approximate what we're trying to solve, which is exactly what we did here. We're essentially, instead of solving that matrix, we solved the bottom one, which is an approximation of what the actual matrix was. And it's a lot easier to solve, so it doesn't take as much brain power to do that. You know, we can do simple substitution and figure out what our solution is going to be. So that is what we're kind of looking for. That's just what we're kind of after, is, hey, is it possible that instead of solving AX equals B, we solve something which is similar to A times X equals B, all right? And then essentially what we have to do there is we're going to say, all right, through this little process, we're going to essentially update the value of X until we get to a value that is closer to what we're looking for, all right? So now we can go through there and we can do some substitutions and we can find out iteratively, get a value that's closer to what we're looking at, you know, 2, 1, and 0.9. Now mind you, this is just after three. After three iterations, we're essentially getting two decimals of approximation closer to our exact solution per iteration. That's actually not typical, but this is a really cool example, which is why I used it. And what's kind of neat too is, so how many of you guys have heard of the Big O notation? All right, so a few of you. So people who are not in the know, most computer scientists, we hate the Big O notation, so we had to deal with that for 4 years in college and 2 years of grad school and whatever. But essentially what Big O notation tells us is how expensive is an algorithm? How much does that algorithm cost? All right, so doing an exact solution for that one, it's O times n to the power 3. So doing it on an iterative basis is O times n to the power 2, that's per iteration though. So this is where we're saying it could potentially be cheaper if the number of iterations we're taking to find our solution is smaller. Okay? Everybody with me so far? So the idea is we're going to iteratively find a solution. We're not going to solve the actual matrix. We're going to solve something similar to the actual matrix through some sort of approximation. And we're going to iteratively solve for X. All right? In hopes that every iteration gets us closer to the exact solution. All right, so this is what it looks like in abstract presentation, right? A bunch more math figures. We're solving A equals B. We've already determined that's going to be too expensive to solve. So we're going to approximate what A is, and now we're going to solve KX equals B. And that's possible to solve and should be cheaper to solve. Now what we're going to do is we're going to define what X sub 0 is going to be. And that, all X zero is just a wild guess. You know, it could be an educational guess as far as we all understand. We look at the problem and say, oh, you know what, X might be this. But it could just be a wild guess. Now, the closer your guess is, the faster you're going to converge. All right, so essentially all we're talking about here is, all right, we're going to solve with our X equals zero, and then we're going to plug X our guess in. It's going to come up with another one, and then we're going to take that guess and we're going to plug it in. That's going to come up with another guess, and so on and so forth. And then what we're going to do is we're going to look at what our R value is going to be, and the R value is going to be gradually reducing and or amplifying. That's the problem there as well, because sometimes they don't converge, they diverge. And we're going to, essentially every time step, we're going to be looking at that. All right. So this is what it looks like computationally. All right, this is what we're really interested in, is we have if A is equal to K minus N, all right, so that's what we're assuming, is A is going to equals K minus N, remember, and then K becomes our approximation. We can say instead of AX equal B, we say KX equals NX plus B, simple math, right, because A is equal to K minus N. So then we say KXI plus 1 is equal to NXI plus B. So that is where our iterative process comes into play at. Xi is our previous guess. Xi plus 1 is current guess. So the current guess is now a function of our previous guess. So our previous guess is we took a wild guess, I'm gonna guess 0, and then we calculate X1, which is based on X0 on our guess, it should be a better guess. Then we take our better guess and we cycle through until that epsilon, until we're very close to epsilon. And once we're there, we say, hey, we found our solution. Okay? All right, so how do we choose our values? All right, so the closer K is to A, remember A and K, or A is our matrix we're trying to solve. K is the matrix that is somewhat close to A. So how is that gonna, how can we solve it? All right, so we know that matrix A, let's go back here. Matrix A is equal to the lower triangle plus the diagonal plus the upper triangle, right? So that says, that is what this is saying, that the closer, the diagonal and the lower triangle essentially gives us A. So A is equal to the diagonal plus the lower plus the upper, okay? So now we can say, all right, you know, just like we did here, where we essentially got rid of half or a third of the problem and just solved two-thirds of the problem, that's what we're going to try and do. So there is a method called Jacobi that does that exact thing. It takes the upper triangle, so it takes the diagonal part, and essentially it takes the diagonal part, and that's what we end up solving for. Gauss-Seidel, which is another method we'll look at, it takes the diagonal and the lower triangle, and then you have the SRR method that essentially takes the diagonal and the lower and it puts a little bit of perturbation in the diagonal, all right? But we're not gonna look at that last method. So Jacobi is what we're gonna first look at. Okay, so what this picture really is trying to tell you is that we're solving for three X's. We're solving for X1, X2, and X3. X0 is gonna be our wild guess. So our wild guess is used to find X1, okay, in same iteration, so this is our first iteration. Then we take that approximate value of X1 and we find X2, take that approximation and we find X3 and we find our solution, all right? So then we take all those three values and we move them to the next iteration and we continue our solution. And then take those values that we compute, go to the next iteration and find our solution. So it looks sort of like this. Actually, we're given a square system of n linear equations, AX equals B. That's our A, solving for X, and then we're gonna find, and then those are equal to B, right? So we're looking at A equals D plus the residuals, or the remainder, right? So D is your diagonal, R is everything else, right? So before I go to this slide, which is actually talking about the method, is everybody familiar with the Jacobi method? Some of you guys are. Have you ever seen it actually in action on paper? So that's actually the coolest part. And once again, I didn't have my dongle because I would show it to you. But there's lots of people who have posted videos that do the exact same thing. So I'm going to pull one of those up. Yeah. Okay. So there's our system of equations. We have, on this slide, we have 5x1 minus x2 plus 2x3 equals 12. 3x1 plus 8x2 minus 2x3 equals negative 25. x1 plus x2 plus 4x3 equals 6. First thing that I look at when I see this, I see that the diagonal is diagonal heavy, right? The majority of the heavy points on each equation comes across the diagonal, which makes life easier for us. And so the matrix that we're solving is 5, negative 1, 2, 3, 8, minus 2, 1, 1, 4, and then you have your vector of x's, and then you have 12, negative 25, and 6. So that's your A, your X, and your B. All right, everybody with me? Okay, if anybody's not, feel free to interrupt. Like I said, I'm a huge math geek, so I love this kind of stuff. All right, so now, I'm going to refresh this. Let's see, I'm going to skip ahead. So we can take that equation, right, and I did have this thing marked yesterday. All right, so we can now say, all right, just through some simple substitution, we could say x1 is the first equation we're looking at. x1 is equal to 12 plus x2 minus 2x3 over 5, right? It's just simple algebra, so we understand what's going on. You know, take everything to the other side, leave x1 over there, and divide it all by 5, and that's what we get. 12 plus x2 minus 2x3 divided by 5. That's our first equation. Now, so those are other three equations that we've substituted. Now, look at what our divisors are. Our divisors are the coefficients of the diagonal. Okay, because that's going to become very important when we actually design this method and write it up in Python. So there's our diagonal, 5, 8, 4, which is what each of the equations is divided by, 5, 8, and 4. Everything goes to the other side. We have coefficients of x2 is equal to negative 25 minus 3x1 plus 2x3. x3 is equal to 6 minus x1 minus x2 all over 4, and so on and so forth, right? So those are the equations we're going to solve for. So what we're going to do now is we are going to do some really simple substitution. At least whoever put this video together will put some easy substitution. So there's our initial guess. Our initial guess is x1 equals 0, x2 equals 0, and x3 equals 0. So essentially what we're going to do is we're going to substitute those values into our equations and see what our results are. So essentially we can take x2, x3, put it in and find a value of x1, then we can find a value of x2 and find a value of x3. So this is our second iteration, okay? And what we end up getting is that, right? For a value of x1, all we did was we substituted x2 equals 0 and x3 equals 0, and we got x1 equals 2.4. And then we'll do that for the other equations as well. We will now take x2 and do a substitutions on there, and we get minus 3.125, and then we take x3, and we do the exact same thing there as well, right? And now, those values, 2.4, negative 3.125, and 1.5, those become our next guess for our next iteration. So just like that picture showed us. So that picture, all right, so we calculate, we're substituting in, we calculate x1, x2, x3, we get those calculated values, and then we put that in the next iteration. That's exactly what's happening here, is now we take those values, and then they go back into the equation, and we solve for our next iteration. If we do these iterations long enough, we will find an approximate value that solves this. And that's really what we're after, is solving this equation, right? And then, of course, we can apply it to even larger matrices if you wanted to, instead of these little teeny tiny guys. So essentially, eventually, you know, we will go through there, we'll find new values of x1, x2, and x3, and we'll get new values, all right? So this is exactly what's happening here. Xk plus 1, that is our current iteration that we're solving for, is equal to the diagonal, or actually diagonal inverse, which means we're dividing by diagonal, b, so b was our answer, minus rx of k. So that is what the remainder values were, of the residuals, remember? So that's exactly what we did in that video. Oh, not that way, this way. So we're dividing by our diagonal. So these are our diagonals. Whoops. So we're dividing by our diagonals, right? And then what's left is our remainder coefficients, 12 and minus 2. And then same thing with the other two. We're looking at the remaining coefficients that are in there. So that's what that equation is telling us. Keep going the wrong way. There we go. So B, which is the final answer that goes to the other side of the equation, right? Minus Rx. So R is the coefficient of whatever's left over in our remainder. And that is how we're finding our new value of xk plus 1. So that's all that is saying. Everything that we've essentially looked at that video that we did by hand is being represented here. And then, of course, we can just do that in a mathematical format, which is the summation of aij, aij being the remainders, right? 1 over aii, aii is 1, a sub 1, 1, a sub 2, 2, a sub 3, 3, so that's our diagonals, right? And now we have a cool little algorithm that we can now plug into a computer, we can write that up, and it'll solve stuff for us. And if everything goes lucky, we can actually calculate what the computationally guess what each value of x sub k is going to be. So this is what the algorithm looks like. And by the end of this, hopefully, you guys will be able to get a chance to go into Python and code this up.
I will show this again here in just a little bit.
Okay. Now, we ignored the lower triangle and the upper triangle in that case, right? So we're just really solving with the diagonal. When you include those back in there, essentially what we have is we have Gauss Seidel. In the short term, what Gauss Seidel does is, all right, essentially what we're doing here is we just found a value of x1, right? We found a value of 2.4, and then we use our initial guess of x1, and we find a value of x sub 2, then we use the initial guess of x2, and we find a value of x sub 3, right? That's exactly what we talked about at Jacobi. What Gauss Seidel says is, like, why do we have to do that? Since we found a better guess of 2.4, why don't we just use that new guess we found out and so put that to find x sub 2? And now that we get a new guess of x sub 2, is why do we have to wait for the next iteration to do the substitution? Why don't we just do it all in the exact same iteration that we're currently at in hopes that we can get to our solution faster? Because the closer your guess is to the actual solution, the better your result is, right? So that's essentially what Gauss Seidel says, is let's not wait for the next iteration. Let's do the substitution in the current iteration. So with that in mind, man, every time, this is what the picture's saying. That, hey, I'm going to calculate x1, and I'm going to use that value, calculating x3, use that value to find x2, use that value to find x1, and then move those to the next iteration, and then go through my guesses. And so essentially the same thing, algorithm actually looks identical, except now we're looking at the triangles as well. So this slide is really, really ugly, and I really apologize for it, but it is what it is. Math sometimes gets really, really ugly, and I can't apologize for that. So we have AX equals B is what we're solving for, you know, and now we're gonna look at the upper triangle and the lower triangle, and now those come into play. And we essentially have the Gauss Seidel method, which is that right in the bottom. Essentially, it's exactly what I was talking about. We're now substituting it at the current iteration instead of the next iteration. Okay. And actually, if you even look at the algorithm looks almost identical as well. All right, so convergence testing, we're gonna stop when we actually figure out when that epsilon is gonna be hit. We can look at the current values of x that we have, and the current divided by the current value of x, and if that's getting close to epsilon, we're good enough. Or we can also make sure that residual is small enough that we're good enough to go. So essentially, as the residual gets smaller and smaller, that k is getting closer and closer to a. So the closer you get to the a, the closer k gets to a, the closer we are to our final solution. All right. So that all takes us to, now that we have all that background knowledge, we have to apply it somehow. Algorithms is really all it takes. So what we're going to do now is we're going to start coding in numerical Python a package called NumPy. So what makes Python really, really cool, and what makes most programming languages cool, is there are libraries and modules which are available to extend the language. All right. Some of you guys who did the Monte Carlo method to solve for pi, you guys did a little bit of Googling and realized, oh, you know, I need to have the random, either use NumPy to generate random numbers, or you actually use the random library to generate random numbers. Those are two modules that you loaded in to be able to generate the numbers for you. Also, I think you had to do some mathematical formulas as well, so you probably did use a little bit of NumPy. So NumPy gives us, it's an extension module for Python. It's a bunch of pre-compiled functions for math and numerical routines, and it adds a little bit of power to your data structures. So essentially what it is lists are great, but when you're dealing with just numbers, lists can become very, very, very slow, all right? So let's I want you guys to go ahead and fire up jupyter.tac.cloud. If you don't remember what that address is, it's right there. And then we'll start playing with a little bit of NumPy. Oh, by the way, so if you guys haven't turned in your training account information where you had to sign your name and stuff, I'll collect those Friday, so that'd be fine as well. You can just hand them back. Something else we're trying to do is figure out a good way for those of you who would like to continue using tax resources, like using our Jupyter notebooks. We're trying to find out a good way to do that. Unfortunately, the training accounts kind of have to go home with me. So when I leave those, because essentially all those accounts are in my name, so I'm responsible for them. That's what somebody reminded me of this morning when I was asking to see if you guys can keep them around for another week or so. Anyway, so what we're trying to do is there's different methods of getting allocations. We'll give you guys what those methods are going to be. Probably find a solution for y'all by Friday. Okay, so Jupyter Tac Cloud is where we're trying to go to. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to import. So what NumPy really does is it gives us the arrays, or gives us vectors and matrices that we can now start playing with. It's one step quicker the way they react with than using standard lists. All right. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and jump in here. So first thing we're going to do is we're going to go and import NumPy as np. So what this line essentially says is that there's a module called NumPy. Instead of us typing NumPy over and over and over and over and over again, we're going to alias that as np, and then we're just going to use np over and over and over again. So each time you see np.array or np.size, np.random, whatever, what we're really doing is we're calling that NumPy module, and we're looking for a method or a function. All right, two words, by the way, you guys should remember: method or function called array, and then we're doing something with that. We have a simple list, right? So what I'm going to do now is we're going to take that list and we're going to convert that into an array, and just one way we can do it. So I'm going to say, all right, capital C. Call it C array equals np.array, and it's going to go ahead and use C build. And now if we just go ahead and print out C underscore array, we should have our little array in there. Okay? Everybody see that? A couple distinctions. C is a list, so if you look at that, there are commas. That's the biggest way of distinguishing it. I'm curious here, what type is C? So C is a list. What type is C underscore array? It's a NumPy NB array, multiple dimension array. Okay, everybody have our quick little array loaded? Because we're going to start playing around with that some more. All right, so what does it give us? So right now, this didn't give us anything, except really what it gave us is one extra line we have to type. Because if we have a list, we could have just left it there, it looks great. But no, I made another line in there and made it into an array. So really all I did was make you guys type more stuff. Okay? But I want you to look at these two lines of code. The first one is print C times 9 divided by 5 plus 32. That is doing a matrix operation on that. So if I did C underscore array, we'll just do exactly what we have there. Print C array times 9 plus 45 divided by 8. So essentially what that did was that multiplied every element inside my array by 9 divided by 5, right? And then added 32 to it. So I got that brand new array. Pretty easy, versus how we would have to do that using lists is we would have to essentially use a for loop, or we can do an implied for loop, which is what this is. But for x and c values, so c values being our list, x times 9 divided by 5 plus 32, we would do that for every element, and then we would print out what our new elements were. So essentially a little bit of left lines of code when we're trying to do some big operations with our array. So things are a little bit easier. But is it really necessary for us to go that route to make it less code? All right? So one more little thing I showed. This is two pieces of code. We have one function. We've all been playing with functions already. So we have a function called pure Python version. We're importing a library called time,
Okay, so time just gives us time functions. We're having a vector of 1,000 elements. What we really want to do is we just want to add two vectors together. So we have x, a vector of size 1,000. We have y, a vector of size 1,000. We have a new vector called z, or new list called z. We're going to go through there, and we're going to multiply and figure out how long that took us. So I'm going to go ahead and paste that in there. So here's our Python version. It's going to, after it's done doing everything, it's going to return how long it took. All right? And here is the NumPy version. All right, so first off, NumPy version is a little bit easier to read. All right, so it's doing the exact same thing. Here we have x is giving us a range, size of vector, so 0 to 1,000. Once again, size of vector. And we're all going to append that to z, and we're going to have a little bit of fun with it. Then we have our NumPy version, which is basically doing the exact same thing, except now z is equal to x plus I. So really, all we're doing is addition here. So we have our two functions loaded. Our size of vector is 1,000. So let's go ahead and call pure Python version. And we'll just run that. So it took 0.0004 seconds to run. Let's look at the NumPy version. The NumPy version actually was a little slower. It took 0.001 seconds to run. All right, so really, I'm not showing you anything that is makes NumPy really stand out, aside from easier lines of code, right? I'm going to do something here. I'm going to rerun. I'm going to clear my output. By the way, if you go to your group all output and clear, they'll clear all your output. And now I'm going to go ahead and run this all again. Okay. In fact, from this last one again, because it took wrong versions of it to run. All right, so we're not really seeing much of a change at all, right? In fact, they're really, really close. But what happens if I change the size of my vector? What if we make that into 100,000 elements instead? Now, let's rerun pure Python version. And now let's rerun NumPy version. Now we have a order of magnitude faster for NumPy versus the pure Python. What if we increase it again? 0.4 seconds versus NumPy, 0.01 seconds. So essentially, this is meant for calculations. And it scales, NumPy scales very, very well versus the pure Python version that does not. In fact, I made my size of vector to be, 10 million? Is that what it looks like? 3, 1, 2, 3, yeah. Pure Python version took 5 seconds to run versus NumPy version took 0.1 seconds to run. So NumPy is actually speeding things up for us. So it's not just, hey, Charlie made us write 4 lines of code, or, Charlie's not showing me anything that's necessary. NumPy does speed things up, and it is actually something when you're trying to solve big, giant problems, all right, not these, what we're about to do with Jacobi, not something small, but something big, NumPy comes in much handier. Okay, so saw which one's faster, NumPy versus pure Python. Okay. So other things that NumPy gives us, it gives us access to multi-dimensional arrays. All right, so it's not just solving these little equations anymore, or these one equations anymore, we can solve larger ones. So we can say, all right, A is gonna be one size of matrix, B is gonna be another size of matrix, and we can get some elements out of there. So let's go ahead and create. I'm gonna go ahead and take this. So now I'm creating a matrix size of X, and this is what the matrix X looks like. And I'm now just printing out what the shape of X is. Remember, that's one of the things that we're always curious about, what the shape of certain matrices are. So we can do that and tell us, oh, it's six columns and, or six rows and three columns. That's what it comes down to be. What's really cool about it is I can change and alter the shape of X, right? So with just a little bit of chance, as long as everything has the same amount of elements, we can change the shape of X. So we can say X dot shape. What if we did want to make that 3x6 instead? All right, now let's print out X. So now that's what X looks like. We can also change the shape of X to say, you know, 2x9. As long as we have the same number of elements. Whoops. We change our shape of that again. Let's print out X again. So now that's our value of X. Two rows, nine columns. And that's what kind of makes NumPy kind of cool, is we can now modify the shape of any of our matrices that we're creating. So it means that okay, so essentially we can do a bunch of cool stuff with shape. It'll tell us what the elements are. We can also access our elements directly using the index, just like we would inside of a list. So if I have, you know, an element X here, I can just say print X, say 1, 9. Actually, that's not what I wanted, sorry. 1, 9, and it'll print that one. What's it like? Oh, 9 is out of bounds, because it starts at 0, 8. All right, so and it'll go through and find out what the row 1, so if index has started 0, so row 1, element 8, what that value is, and we'll go and print that out. So we can now go through there and explicitly put stuff in. That also means we can loop through something and find different values of it. So if I had a loop for I in range 0 to 9 columns, rows, and then colon. For J in range 0 to 9, I can do a, you know, I can set X sub I J, you know, equal to certain values. I set them all to 1 if I wanted to, and run that and, you know, print out X. And we get, you know, our array of 1. So essentially you can go in there, you can modify the values, you can multiply the values by something else, you can multiply arrays, you can do basically tests on individual elements to see what the element value is and run a particular piece of code against it. All right, so everybody's still with me here, because we're gonna keep going a little further. We can also, just like in lists, we can slice. Slicing is always kind of nice because you can essentially peel out certain parts of your array. So let's go ahead and reshape X to a 6x3 meters. All right, so reshape the value of X. We can print X again, what our original code was, and we'll just redo it. All right, so there's our range. We're gonna change that so we have some better values to play with. 0 to 3 and 0 to 6. And we'll change our values to make it I plus J. There you go. Much better. So now let's go ahead and print out our matrix X. And now we can do a little bit of slicing. So if I just say, all right, print X, and let's go ahead and look at X where we want to go from everything to column 1 and everything from 3 on. So now we can do a little slicing and look at individual little parts of the matrix. We can essentially use this to find the upper triangle, or the lower triangle, or the diagonal. Actually, we've got a lot of cool code that can do this as well. What's also kind of neat is we can also create an identity matrix. So if I do numpy.identity and it gives it how big of an identity matrix I need. Say 6x6, it'll go ahead and create a 6x6 identity matrix for me. So if I had a 6x6 matrix, that was one I need to multiply, or to find out what the matrix inverse is, I can then create my identity matrix on the fly. So this is a little bit of, we're not actually going to worry about this too much. This is just a 2D Laplace algorithm. We have two versions of it. One of them is without NumPy. Oh, let's see. One of them is, they're both with actually NumPy. One of them is out slicing, one is with slicing. So
if you look at our, main equation that we're solving for, we have I going in range 1 to nx minus 1. We have j going in range from 1 to 1, ny minus 1. We're creating a temporary variable equals ui comma j. So we're finding the old value of ui comma j, and then we're solving for what the new value is here, right? So uij is equal to ui minus 1j plus ui plus 1j times delta y2 dy2. And then we have ui j minus 1 plus uij plus 1 times dx2. So, you know, we have dx2 and dy2 defined up there because we're using the shape and we're finding out what it's going to be. So then we're looking at times the inverse that we found. And now we're doing our calculation. We look at error and we keep on running through there until the, you know, and we're reporting on what the square root of the error is, right? So just a little simple 2D plus. What's kind of neat with slicing is it looks like that. We've gotten rid of essentially all of our loops, and it makes a little bit more sense to what our code's actually doing. We're saying, all right, u going from 1 to negative 1, ui, where I is going from 1 to negative 1, and j, where it's going 1 to negative 1, we're going to do all that. Negative 2, so when we're saying negative 1, when we're saying 1, that's where it begins at. We're saying negative 1, that essentially gives us the last element, okay? So when we say negative 2, we mean the next to last element. So essentially, when you say 1 to negative 1, it's going from elements 1 all the way to the last element. We're saying 0 to negative 2, we're saying going from element 0 to next to last element, all right? So just by slicing, we can essentially get rid of all the loops and just have one line of code that does it all for us. That's why another part of NumPy that comes in comes in very handy. Okay, so we approximately have about 15 minutes or so, and I gave you a little bit of some hints on how to do this. This is the Jacobi algorithm, okay? And maybe we'll just actually do this together. It might be a little faster. So what we're going to do is we're going to find the diagonal of A, and that's given to us by diag A. We're going to find R, so remember R is the residual. So A is, we're solving A equals B, AX equals B. So A is our matrix. Diag A will give us the diagonal, all right? The remainder is going to be A minus the diagonal, right? But we have to do a little bit of, we have to be a little clever to do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the diagonal of A and we're going to flatten it, and we're actually going to see what that actually looks like. And then we're going to use our D and our R to actually do our computation. Okay, so let's do some live demoing and see how things go.
First off, I'm going to see what the diagonal, what the difference is in diagonal and the difference in flat. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and create a simple matrix,
Sorry again, Charlie.
Yeah.
Los de la UCR ya pueden pasar a tomar su camiseta. Yes. Casi todo el mundo de mesa.
Okay, so I'll leave this kind of code. What we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and create, easiest way to do it is create a 1D matrix of size of 100 elements. We're just going to experiment to see what the different, what diag and diag flat allows us to look at. All right, so here's A. A is going to be a np dot range, gives us this np dot a range, gives us a range of numbers that goes from 0 to 100, or 0 to 99. So if we did this and we looked at the value of A, so I'm going to go ahead and print A, we get, what we expect, an array of values from 0 to 99. Now if we wanted to shift this and make it into a 10 by 10, easiest thing to do is do A dot, oops, capital A. You do A dot shape equals 10 comma 10. Okay? So now, let's go ahead and print out A. So now we have a 10 by 10 matrix. So now let's go ahead and print out A dot diagonal. So now, it gives us, now here's the thing, it gives us an array that contains all the diagonal elements. So 0, 11, 22, 33, 44, et cetera, et cetera, all the way to 99, right? Now let's look what N dot diag flat does. N dot diag flat gave us an actual multi-dimensional array with all the zeros in there. So now we see the triangle, the upper triangle, the lower triangle, and our diagonal, all right? So this gives us the diagonal. Remember, why was that important? Because if we go back to our Jacobi method here, we need our diagonals for what we're gonna divide by.
So we need the b minus rx sub k divided by d. We need those diagonal elements. So we need to know what those individual elements are. Easiest way to do that is called the diag method. All right, once again, key word there, method. The diag method that then gives us what that diagonal is in an array format. So now we can loop through there individually and find them all. Also, the r is our remainder. So we need to subtract the diagonal from A to get that R. So we need R, and the R has to be of a matrix size. So this is essentially what we did. We found our NP diag that gives us this array here. Diag flat shows us that with all the lower and upper triangles in there as well. Now, let's go back to our, there. So now what we're gonna do is we're gonna find out what the remainder is, which is A minus our diag flat. So let's see what that looks like. So if I say, okay, let's print out A, oops, A minus our diagonal, our NP dot diag, oh, I know what I did wrong. We're not looking at the diag flat of A, because that gives us all the elements. All right, anybody see what I did wrong? Remember, every bug I ever make up here is a teaching experience, and I got a really, really bad typo. So, what is diagonal of A? It's kind of right up there. So, all the diagonal elements are what? 0, 11, 22, 33, 44, 55, so on and so forth, right? When I did an A, NP dot a diag flat A, what did that give me? Give me the diag, if I look at the diagonals of, let's just do that, NP dot diag flat, and let's look at NP dot diagonal of that. That is my diagonal. All the elements essentially create a 100 by 100 matrix. It took all the diagonal elements I had, all the elements of A, and made it into a big giant 100 by 100 matrix with the values of A as my diagonal. And that's not what I want. I want that diagonal to be flattened out and made into a 10 by 10 matrix. So let's do that instead. 50 equals that. Okay. Essentially, what I was going to do was np dot diag flat, not A, but np dot diagonal. That is what I'm looking for. So there's my matrix with the diagonals in there and zeros everywhere else. Right? So now if I go ahead and subtract the two together, then I'm actually set this equal to D. And I print A minus D. Now, if I do that, we have our remainder, right? So we have a 10 by 10 matrix, all the elements from 0 to 100. Looking at the diagonal here, those are all my diagonal elements in an array format. So we have 0, 11, 22, 33, 44, all the way across, right? Now what I want to do is we got those all in a line.
I need to make that back into an actual array with those being my diagonal elements, right? So we do the diag flat on our diagonal array that just got created, and that's what gives me this. So we'll print out D. So now D gives me the array with zeros in the upper triangle, zeros in the lower triangle, and 0, 11, 22, 33 all the way across. So there's our matrix with just the diagonals. Do you have a question?
Just trying to make sure that everything's following along.
Sorry. All right. Sorry again, lo de la UNED y UTN, pueden pasar por la camiseta.
I'm sorry? Oh, I created A? Yeah, so all I did was to create A and we can make my life really, really easy. So I made A like this. A is equal to NP dot A arrange, which means array arrange. Array range. And I said to go just 0 to 100. So that gives me to create a one-dimensional array that is goes from all the numbers from 0 to 99, right? And remember, earlier we showed the shape function, so we can take the shape function and change the shape of any array. So then what we did was we changed the shape of A to be a 10 by 10 matrix. So then that converted this one-dimensional array into a two-dimensional 10 by 10 array. So once we have that thing as a 10 by 10 array, it's a little easier to do some matrix functions on it. So the first thing we wanted to look at, remember what we're trying to do is we're trying to write an algorithm that's going to be doing the Jacobi algorithm, right? So things we need to know. We need to know what the diagonal of A is, and we need to know what the remainder is, the upper and lower triangles. Why? Because the diagonal is going to give us the divisors per iteration, and the remainder is going to give us the coefficients per iteration. So we have to find those two values. So to do that, we get our matrix, we find our diagonal, and that's what this does. The diag A gave us all the diagonals. But this is in the format of an array. We need that to be in a format of a matrix. So our NumPy gives us this really cool method called, once again, there's that keyword method, gives us a method called diagflat. What that does is it takes an array and it makes it into a matrix and giving those values the diagonal. So now, by doing diag flat on diag array, so diag array is this guy, diag of A, it now created this method, this matrix with that triangle on it, with those values as the diagonal. Okay? Once we have that, so this gives us our D. Now what we need is our R. So R is going to be A minus D. So this is what this gave us. So I'm going to say R equals A minus D. And print R. So now we have our diagonal, which is the above matrix, 10 by 10. We have this matrix, which is all the elements outside of the diagonal, because we already have those. Now that we have all of our pieces together, we can go ahead and calculate. First off, though, we can't solve this matrix using Jacobi, right? Because to use Jacobi, your diagonal has to be the heaviest point. We can't do that because the diagonal here is not the heaviest point. All the other elements are much larger, or the sum of all the elements are much larger than the diagonal. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and go back to that first problem we solved on our slides, and we're going to make that into our A, and then we'll see if we can write Jacobi together and do our solution. All right, so hopefully everybody's with me on that. Okay, so we found our D. We'll go ahead and set up our equation here. So we need to set up our A. A is going to equal, and we'll just go back to our original slide, that first equation we're trying to solve at the very beginning, which is this. So our equation is going to be 0.1, 0.4, or I'm sorry, yeah, 0.1, 0.4, 1. And I
When I build a raise by hand or build a matrix by hand, I actually prefer to build it as a 1D matrix and then break it up as I need to. And then we will do slight problem here. A is actually a list. We need to make that into an array to actually be able to change the shape. So A is going to equal, remember we did that before where we converted a, our very first loop we went there, we created a list called C values, and then we converted that to an array. That's the same thing we'll do here. So A is going to equal np.array of small a. All right, now, look at the shape of A. It's 9, and let's change the shape to 3 by 3, and let's look at the value of A again. Print A. So now we have a 3 by 3 matrix that we're solving for. Point 1. We made some modifications to this just to make it easier to solve. So I'm looking at it going, this looks like it's going to be a Gauss-Seidel and not a Jacobi, but we don't know. Let's find out. Let's keep going. All right. Now that we have our matrix, first thing we need to do is find out what our diagonal is, right? So we're going to find out D. D is going to equal A dot diag. NP dot diagonal of A, okay? R is going to equal the remainder, because that's going to be A minus the NP dot diag flat of D, not A. So we will print out A, or we'll print out, so there's A, we'll print out D. Just to make sure we have all of our pieces together. That's our diagonals. We'll print out R. Okay, so 0 along the diagonals, and we have coefficients everywhere else. The next thing we're gonna do is we're gonna take our initial guess and we're gonna start iterating, okay? So to do that, and we're gonna change it up a little bit. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to just do a fixed number of iterations just to kind of get used to it, see how things look. So we're going to go ahead and do a loop. So I'm going to say for I in range, and for a number of time steps, let's go ahead and do 1,000. Let's do 1,000 time steps for now. Hold on. Next thing what we do is we have to X is going to equal something. So what we're solving for is X, right? And we're also going to give our initial value of X. And X is going to be a matrix of our initial guess, which is 0, 0, 0, and NP dot array. Now, X is going to equal, well, what is it? It's B, so we have to still figure out a B matrix. B matrix. B is going to be, of course, go all the vector slides, do a very beginning. B was equal to 5, 10, and 3. Okay, now we're ready to solve. We have A, X, and B. AX equals B is what we're trying to solve, right? So I'm going to do 4. I in range, and I said we're going to do 1,000 time steps to begin with. What we're going to do now is we're going to calculate X. All right, X is equal to what? Well, let's go back to our Jacobi slide and see what X is equal to, what our next guess of X is going to be. X is equal to, right here, B minus our sum divided by our diagonal, right? Essentially, X is equal to B minus the dot product of R and X. Because remember, we're taking all the remaining values that we have. Those are going to become our coefficients to X, right? So that is what we're trying to solve for. And we're dividing by the diagonal D. Remember, this is Python. We don't have to actually loop from element to element anymore. We can do all of our computation using one. So X is going to equal B minus the dot product is dot, so NumPy dot What are we multiplying? We multiplied R, which is all the remaining, and X, and then we divide by the diagonal. Because remember, going back to our actual Jacobi mathematical notation, SIL, Jacobi, there it is. It's going to be B, what is AII times XJ, AIJ times XJ. This is the matrix dot product of a matrix and our vector, right? That's what that essentially represents. Because this is Python, we can just represent it as NP dot R, which is this AIJ times X, which is this X of J, right? So, looking at B minus dot product of R and X, dot product of R and X, all divided by AII, which is our diagonal, all divided by B. So if we're to run this, let's go ahead and print out. So, oh, it didn't work. It failed. Because look at, the entire idea is to get these X's closer and closer together, right? And remember I said that for us to actually, so if you look at these individual values of X, remember, failure just shows us that a method didn't work right. And I kind of gave you a heads up that I don't think that that Jacobi is going to be able to solve that problem because the diagonal was one of the weakest parts of the equation. So, but we can see that it is failing because x1 or x at iteration 0, which is our initial guess, x at iteration 1, x at iteration 2, that gap is growing every time. And it's growing exponentially, which means method just didn't fail. It failed brilliantly. So what we're essentially saying is that equation that we're trying to solve is not something that Gauss-Seidel can solve. But we can change our equation around and force it to be heavier down, diagonal heavy. So let's just replace some of these variables here. X, let's make that 3, and make that 0.2, and instead of minus 0.5, we'll make that one again. Okay, so there's our A. A is 9 by 9. We're going to change the shape to 3 by 3. So now that's what A looks like. And now if you notice, it is diagonal heavy. So there's our diagonal, right? There's our remainder. We'll set up our X. We'll set up our X. And we'll set up our B. And let's run this now. Now, if you look at it, it's a much easier matrix to solve. So the first iteration, 5, 3, 3, not very good at all. But then as you start looking, it is starting to converge on an answer until we're looking at essentially the size of epsilon is starting to get smaller and smaller until we're not noticing a change anymore. So there is our solution to that 3 by 3 matrix. And if we wanted to, we could easily convert this into we could convert Jacobi into a function, which we'll do really, really quick. And then all you have to do is submit a value for A, a value for B, and X, and you should be ready to go. So let's do that real quick. Let's convert it into a function, and then we should be set to take a break. Yeah. All right. So let's do Jacobi. I'm going to do a definition, and we're going to call this Jacobi. What does Jacobi need? Jacobi needs a Jacobi needs a matrix A, it needs a matrix B, it needs an X, and we're going to give it the number of time steps as well. Okay? What is D is going to equal the diagonal of A, right? Everything we did up there, we're going to just redo inside of the function. R is going to equal A minus, not D, because because D is just the array, A minus NP dot diag flat of D. And that would begin a loop for I in range number of time steps. You want the user to decide how many time steps you want. And now all we're going to do is set x equal to exactly what we did before, which is b minus np dot of the two matrices, which is r and x, and all that is divided by our diagonal d. And if you wanted to print out x, you could. That's always kind of fun to do. What we have to do is just return our x matrix. So that is the Jacobi algorithm in Python. So if we wanted to call it, we could just say Jacobi. A, B, and X, and we want to do 1,000 time steps. And we run it. And it goes ahead and calculates it for us. And our final value of X is our solution, or our approximate solution. All right, any questions on that? Remember, the entire reason we're doing this exercise is because we're trying to always solve AX equals B. It doesn't matter if we're doing deep learning or if we're doing visualization and we're trying to rotate a 3D object in space. We're solving AX equals B. That's really all we're doing. And because of computational power, and because of approximation methods, we're going to be able to try and solve it using iterative approximation methods instead of trying to find a direct solution. Because a direct solution can be very expensive versus iterative methods, we can actually apply very quickly and find a solution. Less brain power, more horsepower. All right? Any questions on this, guys? Fantastic. Okay. I guess. Yeah. Oh, on the, you want to see the algorithm? Yes. Right here. I find it very elegant. It's a very elegant solution. Okay. There's no questions. It's a coffee, right? Okay, coffee break. Thanks, guys.